Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Jennifer Irving. I'm an enrolled member of the Gullah Sioux Tribe located in southwestern South Dakota on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Both my mom and my dad are from Pine Ridge, so basically that means I can't marry anybody from my reservation ever. Just kidding. I think there was like one guy I could date, and I dated him, so it's not going to happen. Just kidding. All right, so I know in the book it was listed I was going to talk about sacred place and I think Indian spirituality, but I kind of wanted to shift a little bit based kind of on the video and on my colleagues' presentations as well. I just finished up a stint in my tribal president's office. I was his legislative liaison, and so I kind of have some of context in terms of tribal sovereignty and self-determination and kind of the impact on environmental health. So I'll be giving some examples of that. And first, let me start with just telling you a little bit about this picture here. This actually comes out of Canada, and it was a picture of a woman, and she was basically, I mean, it comes from an actual photo. This is just a drawing kind of representing what she was, and they were protesting a pipeline in Canada. And so it's just this mom, and she's on her knees, and she's basically holding up an eagle feather saying, "This is what I'm fighting for," was, again, the sacredness of place. And so this picture and this drawing has kind of circulated the globe, and yeah, it comes from actual lady. And so I just kind of think that's kind of where we're at today a little bit, is, you know, we don't necessarily fight with guns or bullets, but, you know, our words and our beliefs. So the lens that I'll be talking through today is based in tribal sovereignty. So what does that mean? Kristen helped paint the picture a little bit about what sovereignty is, and it's, you know, based in legality and law. It's not just a theory or, you know, something we kind of believe. This is actual law. And so the lens that I'll be talking through today is, you know, tribes are independent entities. We have the right to govern ourselves. We are subject to the powers of Congress, and a little fun fact is American Indians are the only set of people listed in the Constitution. So go find it. Just kidding. That's your homework. Just kidding. And for the most part, as tribes, we deal directly with the federal government. That doesn't mean we don't partner with states. That doesn't mean we don't get money from states. But for the most part, we'll go right to the feds. And just highlighting again, we have a very unique relationship with the United States government. We look at ourselves as nations. And so we deal with the United States government on a nation-to-nation basis. Last bullet there. So where did it come from, right? Where did this idea come from? And I could spend the whole time talking and the rest of the day talking about the history of tribal sovereignty and how it's been exercised and where it's been fought. It's really based on three cases, what we call the Marshall Trilogy. And yes, that is a typo. Based on the three cases of Johnson v. McIntosh, Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, for those in the room who don't, who kind of want a better understanding, I would say go look up Cherokee Nation versus Georgia and some of the history that the Cherokee Nation people faced in the Trail of Tears. I think some people might be familiar with that history and, you know, the impacts of those things. And so I won't spend too much time here. That is John Marshall there. Stunning fellow. Just kidding. I don't know. But he was a Chief Justice in the Supreme Court, and so some of his decisions that really provided the foundation and the framework for Indian law that we see today. So let me go a little bit into self-determination, because some people say, well, they're the same. Sovereignty and self-determination, they're the same. And again, I could spend the whole time talking about the difference. And I think Kristen really talked about the self-determination era, and that's what we're in today. That is President Nixon with some of our Indian leaders back in the 60s. And he really was a big champion for Indian people to kind of push and those policies forward in terms of self-governance and, you know, transferring some of our Indian land back to our tribes, and then really highlighting that Indian tribes can run these programs. So we don't need the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Before this time, it was Bureau of Indian Affairs will run everything, and we can employ Indian people. That's great. You know, but it was really during this period in time where it was, you know, the idea was we can run some of these programs, right? So if we look at Department of Natural Resources, tribes were able to say, we want to run that program. And when we look at some of our health facilities and our health clinics and health programs, we were able to point and say, we want to run those programs. We can do it. We can do it better. So that's an important piece. And I don't want to downplay, you know, there were lots of Indian tribes also pushing for this as well. It wasn't just Nixon and him saying, hey, this is great. But it was, you know, the work of many tribes and many tribal leaders saying, we could do this. And so, anyway. So what does it mean? It means we have the right to form our own governments, the right to make and enforce our own civil and criminal justice system, which becomes an important part when we start talking about regulation. We have the power to tax, to establish our own membership. So this becomes more important when we start talking about gaming and that kind of thing. But the part that's important in terms of environmental health was really we had the right to license, zone, and regulate activities. So whereas in the past when companies would come and set up shop and, you know, they would work through the state or with the feds to get that approval, we were now in a position to say, wait a minute, what are you doing? No, you need to get our approval first. And then we also had the power to exclude people or companies from tribal territories. And so I think you've seen on the video a little bit about our counterparts in Alaska. They're a little bit different because tribal boundaries aren't so defined as some of us in the 48. So they have a little bit more trouble in terms of saying, hey, we want to regulate and we want to make sure you're following standards and regulations. So what does this mean for environmental health? I think I kind of started going into that a little bit. But that really means that tribal governments have the authority to enact our own health regulations. And because we're not subject to state public health laws, we can actually enact stricter or sometimes in terms of like smoking regulation, which still drives me crazy, we could be a little bit more lenient, right? So when states go smoke-free in X, Y, and Z, sometimes tribes don't like in casinos, you know? And I was really pushing since I live in the state of Minnesota now. I did in the past, and I moved back to South Dakota, and I'm back in Minnesota. Anyway, the first time I lived in Minnesota, you know, we were having this debate in Minnesota about going smoke-free statewide. And so I'm like, wouldn't it be cool if states beat them to the punch? I mean, tribes beat them to the punch. Wouldn't it be cool if they said all our casinos are going to go smoke-free, all of our restaurants are going to go smoke-free and beat the state to the punch? But it didn't happen that way. That would have just been my dream. Anyway, so just a nice little aside. So that means for us, you know, looking at sovereignty, looking at self-determination, we as tribes then and our members, we get to draft legislation and design our own public health approaches that are influenced by our own beliefs, our own traditions, and our unique needs. So let's go into some examples. And I don't know if y'all could see that very well, but because it's really bled out here. Anyway, so we'll just take Navajo Nation. Is there any Navajos in the room? There's got to be somebody who's Navajo in the room. There we go. I knew it. Yes. Just kidding. Navajo Nation is our largest tribe in the United States. This here is just an example of how big it is. I like to show this graphic because you can look and see it spans. I mean, it sits in four state area. But if you look at that, if you look to the eastern seaboard and you see some of those states, I mean, Navajo Nation is bigger than some of our eastern states here. And even if they combine themselves, they would still be, you know, Navajo Nation would still be bigger than two or three states combined. And so a lot of Indians in one place. And there's a Hopi community. The tribe sits right in the middle somewhere in there. So I don't want to, if there's any Hopis in the room, don't get mad at me. Okay. I acknowledged. So we want to just take a look at some of the examples that Navajo Nation, the regulations that they've developed, right? Being the largest tribe, they have a lot of tribal members, and so they're able to, you know, develop their own public health departments and then therefore set forth regulations that really fit within Navajo Nation. So these are just some of the examples that you see, very similar to some of the federal regulations. They have their own EPA, they have their own Clean Water Act, and they also have their own oil and gas code. And so just something to take a look at there. We talk, in looking at some of those regulations too, we see that they're very similar to the federal counterparts, but again, focus very specifically on cultural practice and historical site and that sacred site preservation that we keep talking about. And so I'll just highlight, I read through all of them and I was like trying to pull out the best ones, but I'll just highlight two of those. Their EPA, you know, they really look at the preservation of their tribal culture and religious sites. And so they're able to say, you know, we want to protect these areas, so therefore our codes and our ordinances will be very specific to certain things. And then also you'll notice that the language is a little bit different. I think we talked a little bit about in the video always looking forward to the generations to come. So we recognize that what I do today, the work I do for my people, the work I do around the land, is going to affect our generations to come. And so you'll see language like that in some of our tribal ordinances. You'll see language about succeeding generations or for the next seven generations, because that's what we're brought up to believe and that's what we're brought up to think forth. You know, so even the work I do in public health will always impact, you know, not just my children, my grandchildren, but, you know, generations to come. And when we look at their Clean Water Act, it was really about water source, and that was really the point I wanted to make here around their Clean Water Act, was they have very strict water quality restrictions for religious purposes, and so they were able to identify certain spots that where this water comes here goes into this lake, so therefore that lake we consider sacred, we consider important, and so we have to have very strict water quality restrictions and also have very strict water testing in those places. And then really looking at oil and gas production and how it could impact that religious site. You know, in North Dakota, we're seeing a big boom in terms of the oil industry. And so some of these things weren't in place there. And so now there's kind of a little bit of backtracking, and now we're going into Montana in terms of oil development. And you're starting to see tribes there kind of set forth ordinances and laws that kind of mimic some of what Navajo Nation has done to protect some of their sacred sites. The thing with that is, before I go on to the wind energy project, some of our sacred sites don't fit within or don't fall within our reservation boundaries. And so, like for us as the Lakota people, our Black Hills sit to the west of us, and we can see them, we can point to them, but they don't sit within our reservation boundaries, so we're not able to enact some of the things that we would like to protect them appropriately. All right, so let me shift gears a little bit. We're going to head north into South Dakota and talk about the multi-tribal wind energy project. I wish that's what it looked like out my back door, but not yet. So there are six tribes in South Dakota, Lakota and Dakota tribes that unite. And I always tell this joke, but, you know, you could tell a Lakota because they'll say, put another log on the fire. You could tell a Dakota because they'll say, put another dog on the fire. Ha ha. It's just dialect. It's just about dialect. We're all related. We're all related. Anyway, so in South Dakota, tribal lands cover about 16 to 18% of the state. Some say 16, some say 18, whatever. I just said 16 to be conservative. And we've had multiple wind studies come through there. There's been multiple attempts to put wind farms in South Dakota. Just hasn't ever picked up because of who's going to buy it. And then there's a transmission issue. And so some of the wind studies say that we could generate, based on our reservations and where these wind farms would go, could generate 784 megawatts of power. So as I'm reading this from the president of my tribe, I'm like, what does that mean? I need to deconstruct this. What does 1 megawatt produce? Well, 1 megawatt can generate enough electricity for 350 homes. And so if we're looking at 784 megawatts of power, it's estimated that we could generate enough power to service Denver for the next 20 years. I mean, given that Denver don't, you know, grow and all of that kind of stuff. But anyway, so, you know, we look at it not only as a way to provide cleaner energy to the country and to help alleviate some of those burdens, but, you know, you're looking at some of these counties and some of these tribes in South Dakota are some of the poorest in the country. We're not just the state of South Dakota, but some of the poorest in the country, and they rival some of the poorest counties in the South. And so when we look at a big project like this, we're looking not only to, you know, help protect the environment, but to alleviate some of our own tribal struggles with poverty, joblessness, and then, you know, really working to develop some kind of economy for our young people. So working with our tribal colleges to say, hey, some of these kids could be going to school to learn skills that'll help not only build this wind energy project, but also maintain it, you know. Again, I mentioned before, some of our obstacles, though, is buyers. Who's going to buy it? We have California saying, we'll buy your energy. You know, they're pushing their grid to the max, and you know, they anticipate in the next 5 to 10 years they won't have enough energy to meet the demands of their citizens out in California. So they're saying, we'll buy it, but then it's like, how do we get it there? You know, there's all these transmission lines, and every time I see a power line now, I think differently, like, who owns that? I wonder where that's going, because that's really the new frontier, is how do we get energy where it needs to get, you know, where it needs to go. So anyway, so I just wanted to highlight this picture. That's my Uncle Bill Clinton in the middle. Just kidding. I'm a Democrat. So my boss is on stage. She's the one with the cane. The one next to him is Chairman Shepard from Sisseton. And then the chairman from Rosebud is to the right of my boss, President Brian Brewer, former boss. Sorry. He still thinks he's my boss, but anyway. And that was back in June. They were brought on stage, highlighted this wind energy project, and now we're just looking for funding, you know, that fun stuff about money. Anyway, so self-determination really does extend beyond tribal governments. We're looking at tribal members and tribal organizations now have shifted some of their thinking. You know, when we talk about self-determination, yes, it's a federal policy, but I think a lot of younger American Indian people have grasped onto this idea as, I'm a self-determined individual. I have the right to health. I have the right to a clean environment. I have the right to, you know, grow up in this way, to speak my language, to go to school, to come back and do ceremonies. And so this self-determination idea has really extended to a way of thinking for young people and to our communities. And so here you see three different pictures I'll just highlight real quick. I'll talk about the solar panel project later on, the one in the middle. But the one to the left, you'll see, you know, tribes coming together to really fight against the XL pipeline that'll come through. And they were really smart in some of their design, especially in the state of South Dakota. The pipeline is designed to kind of go in and around tribal communities, but not through any of them, with the idea of, well, we're not hitting any reservations, so we don't have to deal with those Indians. Okay, that's not what they said, but that's the idea. But as Indian people, we don't look at our sacred places and our places that are important to us as just being on our reservation. We look at, you know, we have a whole historical area, and all of that was important to us. And just because it fits outside of our reservation doesn't mean we don't take it under consideration. So there, it's further south, I think in Oklahoma. We have the Ponca Nation there that, you know, came forward. They actually drove all the way from Ponca to Rapid City in early May to be a part of a consultation with the XL Pipeline people, and we ended up walking out. Anyway, so then on the right-hand side, you have some grandmas, and that's Miss Faith Spotted Tail, and there they're actually talking about uranium in the Black Hills. And again, because the Black Hills don't sit within our reservation communities, there's a belief that, you know, we shouldn't care, but the Black Hills are very sacred to us, and so our grandmas are leading the way. So one example of kind of a grassroots organization, again, taking that the belief of self-determination, is the Lakota Solar Enterprises Project, and that's located on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. It was started by an individual named Henry Red Cloud in partnership with a nonprofit organization called Trees, Water, and People. And so they wanted to look at, you know, how can we do things better for our people? How do we provide energy sources? And then, you know, how do we build more Indian individuals that want to do some of this work? And so they really look at solar heating systems for some of our houses, especially our elderly and those that are disabled. And they're also trying to do this training. I don't want to say school, because that's not what Henry calls it, but really this training opportunity, I guess, for young people across the country to come there, learn different things. It's like, you know, they have a 6-week program, they have an 8-week program, and they learn all kinds of stuff. But it's really about providing alternatives and really trying to help, again, this First Nations people become more energy independent, even though we're in some of the most impoverished places. And so this young man here, he has just had this new solar air heater installed over the summer. They anticipate that 20 to 30% of his heating bills will be decreased over decades. And so if you think of While 20 to 30%, maybe that's not that big, but for him it is. You know, if you're living on limited income, you're disabled, that's going to be something that helps. And we like solar because it's not a moving part. You know, the wind energy is a moving part. Stuff breaks, you got to maintain it. This, you just kind of have to wipe off and move on, you know. Again, these are the young men that came across from all different tribes across the country, came to Henry's place to kind of develop their own green business plans and learn more about solar panels, how to put them together, how much it takes for a building, and how they can also take that solar heating program back to their own reservations. And so I will leave with this. I think, you know, we're at a time and a place where we really have to figure out how we relate to our own environment, you know, water, land, air. It's not just about building pretty buildings anymore. It's about building eco-friendly buildings. It's about building systems that really will take care of us as we go forward. So that's who I am, and I will turn it over to Ralph. Okay. And then you can save questions for me later.